Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene. If you're listening via our new Bloomberg Radio Plus iPhone app, did you know you can also hear market updates on demand? Simply tap on Bloomberg Market Minutes. The reports are updated every half hour. If you don't have the Radio Plus iPhone app yet, you'll want to download it. It's free via the iTunes App Store.
And joining us now, James Bullard of St. Louis. Good morning, sir.
Well, welcome to St. Louis, the home of the World Series.
It's an exogenous shock, to say the least. They were a zillion games out in August, given up for dead. Back they come, and you can feel the celebration in the city. And yet coming in from the airport, I go by Keener Square and occupy St. Louis. It's almost too clashing. There's a lot to take in St. Louis as there is around the nation.
I think it's mostly about baseball today, and I think the Cards will do very well. I sent a message to my colleague Richard Fisher saying,
"What's the bet?
I heard you had a baseball team in Dallas. I was not aware of this."
I like this idea. Well, Charlie, we should just go right on to Dallas after this and do a World Series tour. Let's talk economics here, and I want Ken to jump in here as well. You, perhaps more than anyone visibly at the Fed, have said, okay, it was a bubble, and we have to come to grips with it's a bubble. And the thrust of your recent work is we have to forget about getting back to the 2007 peaks. Why do we need to do that?
Well, of course, we'll eventually get back to the 2007 peak, but it won't be very rapid. And part of that is very much that, you know, all the rhetoric about this is that, you know, it was a real estate bubble, and all the evidence points to that. What is still down today among the components of GDP? It's not consumption, it's not government spending, it's not exports, it's investment, and it's the components of investment that are related to real estate. So that very much looks like a collapsed real estate bubble, which fits with everybody's description, but our models don't deal with bubbles very well. Our models just talk about, fundamental balanced growth paths and stuff like that.
Well, this is a good question for somebody in the Midwest. Is farmland the next bubble?
You know, I've watched that very closely, and I talk to people around the 8th District. I always ask that question. My former colleague Tom Honig was also very worried about this. You do see some prices for farmland that seem to be pretty high, but I think it's not a bubble at this stage. But it's something I'll keep very close on. Yeah.
When you look at the bubble, I think of Steve Roach's debate. Chairman Bernanke touched on this at the Economic Club of New York. Can we link our research and our models into asset prices? Can we actually believe we can get out in front of a bubble and run a monetary policy essentially on our balance sheet as well?
Well, I think that, you know, the main issue for policymakers, and this debate has been going on for 15 years, the notion that you could just let the bubble dissolve and all would be well and you'd clean up afterwards, that has come under a lot of challenge and a lot of attack and still remains the core problem.
How do you tell it's a bubble before it bursts? I mean, after it bursts, it's pretty easy.
Well, for housing, I think there wasn't too much question. People often forget that if you were around in 2004, 2005, and you picked up a copy of The Economist or something, it would say housing bubble in the U.S. on the cover. And you know, Chairman Greenspan at the time did testify about house prices. They were out of line with nominal GDP. And so it looked like something had to happen, something had to give, and so it's not impossible, I don't think.
When you look at your other work and an important paper you wrote up recently, The Seven Faces of the Peril, you talk about the fear, not so much of Japan and the malaise of Japan, but the idea of falling into a steady state is the economic language that we can't get out of, where we're trapped almost into not a malaise, but just we're trapped into a set of policies that puts us nowhere on a growth path. Are we anywhere near that? Are we at risk of being in a unfortunate steady state?
We are at risk of getting stuck in that steady state because the typical policy response, the knee-jerk reaction to a weaker economy is to say, well, we'll have to stay at zero policy rates for even longer. If you, as you stay at zero policy rates for longer and longer and longer, you come to more and more risk that you'll actually never move off zero policy rates. Japan has been below, has not been above 50 basis points on its policy rate since the mid-90s, so more than 15 years now. And we have to be cognizant of that as a possibility.
What do the dissenters say on the Fed that rings true to James Bullard? You are not a dissenter. There are two, three, four, President Lacker speaking the other day. What are the dissenters concerned about when you sit at the FOMC table? How do you listen to them? What are you listening for from the dissenters?
Well, it's a very collegial environment, but people have strong opinions about monetary policy. I think the notion that we have to be very careful with our unconventional policy, this could go badly awry if we're not careful. Obviously, the economy is not performing as well as we'd like, but on the other hand, we've got an extremely accommodative monetary policy. It seems to me we're appropriately calibrated, at the current juncture. But, I'm happy to listen to my colleagues. They're all very, very, very good, and listen to what they have to say on both sides.
I'd like your thoughts on the Fed's decision to keep interest rates near historic lows for another 2 years. I mean, for a stated period of time.
Yeah, I didn't like putting the 2013 language actually in the statement. I think you should make policy according to the state of the economy, not according to the calendar. And for that reason, I didn't like that particular approach to policy. It also creates some problems. Now you're a couple months along. And, depending on what you think about the economic situation, maybe you should change the date now. And that's very awkward for the committee to be trying to move that date around. So hopefully we can get a better approach to that going forward.
Well, is it also telling me that if I kind of want a new house or a new car, but I don't absolutely have to have one, that I can just wait? There's no hurry.
The option value to waiting. That effect is probably there. You often see if people think rates are going to rise, for instance, you'll see the housing market move on account of, for instance, or other interest-sensitive sectors. You'll get some movement because they think low rates are going away. So that effect is probably there.
Let me talk about Fed independence, if we will. James Bullard with us, folks, the president of the St. Louis Fed, with us for this entire hour. When you look at Fed independence, at the Bloomberg Washington Post debate, I was floored by the pile-on of Chairman Bernanke. It made Arthur Burns look like a half-stepper. It was just remarkable. Your thoughts as we fought to 1951 to get Fed independence under McChesney Martin, and now it's completely threatened again, isn't it?
I like to call it not independence, but arm's length from politics. The Fed is it's a political institution in the sense that the Board of Governors is all presidential appointees approved by the Senate, and all the presidents are approved by the Board of Governors. So it definitely has political accountability, but it has some distance from the day-to-day politics. And we know that countries that don't offer that distance get into a lot of trouble with their monetary policy. So I think it is extremely important to maintain Fed independence as we have it. I don't think Congress wants to be making monetary policy directly in the Congress. We see how dysfunctional Congress can be on many dimensions, and I don't think they'd be very good at making timely decisions on these matters.
I want to talk right now about the character. I said this earlier in the interview, besides the shock of non-Keynesian coffee, is you fly in and there's that gateway, and there's just something about when we grew up in St. Louis, and yet this Fed was also very different. It is a highly distinctive Fed. What did Homer Jones do? What did Thomas Melzer do? What did Professor Poole do of Brown University that is a legacy that you run today?
There's a great tradition of research and independence at the St. Louis Fed, and we try to keep up that great tradition, live up to the the past that you know that has occurred here, and you know, hopefully we do a good job. I wouldn't say that, you know, of course it was a great monetarist bank for a long time, but I wouldn't try to relive the monetarist debate, you know, over again, because debates evolve and change over time. We want to be on the frontier all the time and not rehash, you know, arguments that were made a long time ago.
Olivier Blanchard at the IMF had an entire seminar, a 3 or 4 day study of the models of economics and the shock over how economists got so much of this financial crisis wrong, its amplitude, its size, and its scale. Are you moving on to a new kind of economics as you try to guess what the American economy will do, or can you use the present models?
I think we need to improve our models dramatically, and I would, you know, I would take even the most sophisticated models that are out there, and I would say those are still not enough. So we still have to get far more sophisticated even than those models. They have to have meaningful financial sectors in which there can be a crisis. One of the things that happens in economic modeling is that since there often isn't a crisis, then you say, well, I'm going to abstract from that as a problem, and I'm going to analyze the economy, and I'm going to build my model not worrying about that. And then the crisis comes along and you don't have anything in your model to deal with it. So, but these are the kinds of things that, you know, we have to do a much better job as macroeconomists dealing with these things. And to be fair, if you read the literature, you will see that there are a lot of papers. There is a lot of research on financial crisis and how finance might interact with the macroeconomy. But it doesn't get top billing and has not received top billing in the past.
My colleague Ken Pruitt loves to describe the map of any given Federal Reserve District, and St. Louis is the most interesting one. You go from Memphis to Little Rock, and you can tell it was negotiated over three stiff drinks in 1914 or whatever. I'm going to take Sonia Yates Hubbard, Chief Executive Officer of Easy Mart Stores Texarkana, Texas, is one of your board members. When you look at the people you need to talk to, what are you hearing from your board members? What are you hearing from this district about economic recovery? And specifically, what would they like from Washington?
Well, Sonia runs Easy Mart, a chain of convenience stores. I think there's 300 or 350. I love that business. I love to talk to her about her business because you know, it's talking about gas prices, for instance, and indoor sales and travel. And she's in 4 or 5 states, I think, right in the southernmost part of the district. So it's really great to get some feel for, you know, that particular industry in that part of the country.
Does she want and do you want more inflation? There's any number of people talking about a need to get nominal GDP going again to get the animal spirit. Can we manage a little more inflation and have confidence we can keep the genie in the bottle down the road? We can get the inflation back down when appropriate?
Well, no, I don't want a lot of inflation. I don't think a typical person out here in Main Street America wants to see prices going up.
Only in evil New York do they want that?
That's right.
I mean, it really goes, but this is important. This goes back to the heritage of the Fed and the distrust in 1890 and 1880 between agricultural America and those guys in New York, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And it's all about, there's three parts to the Fed. One part is in D.C. and you have to have a political part. There's one part in New York City and you have to have a Wall Street component, but there's also a Main Street component to the Fed, and it was all about getting some of the power outside of Washington and New York and making sure that these important decisions weren't dictated just by East Coast interests, and I think it's worked fairly well over the last century or so.
Are we getting enough from this institution? Are we do we need to be more visible, or is there a possibility in this crisis that the Fed is too visible? We have too much information.
No, I don't think we're too visible. I think these are complicated policies, even for insiders like me who have been around a long time, and it's just a different era for monetary policy. So I think it's incredibly important that we get out as much as we can and try to talk about Fed policy and answer all the questions that we can. Otherwise, if we don't do that, then there's others that are already talking and doing the talking for us, and then we can get a twisted picture of what the policy is really about.
I like twisted. We have Operation Twist, this idea of extending maturity. Nice segue. He's very good, Vollmer. I mean, he's smooth as all get out. So we twisted. And are we running out of tools? Anthony Orphanides talks about the toolkit that we have at the Fed. Are we running out of Fed tools?
No, I'm not one to say that we're running out of tools now or ever. And I think as long as the Fed can create inflation, you've got a powerful toolkit. And so, the key, though, right now is that I think, you know, the economy's not performing as well as we would like, but we also have a very aggressive monetary policy. So I would say that the monetary policy is appropriately calibrated for the situation. And if things should weaken substantially or there'd be, further problems, the Fed can take further action.
Ken, well, the word is calibrated today.
Yeah.
He's used the word calibrated twice.
Well, I was
about to
ask.
It's a calibrated Bloomberg surveillance.
I was about to ask, what if Operation Twist doesn't work? Then what?
Well, Operation Twist is just selling some of our shorter dated treasuries and buying some of the longer dated. I think there's a limit to how much of that we can do. That's one part of it. I do think there's some analysis inside the Fed that suggested that this would have some impact. So we'll go ahead with it. But I think if we needed to do more, I think and needed to get more aggressive, I think it would have to be through further outright bond purchases, and so that's probably our most potent weapon. But I think policy's already appropriately easy, I don't think we're in any position to do that right now.
How do you respond to financial repression, the idea of savers with a low interest rate, the five-year yield becoming the new three-month CD, and the 30-year bond becoming the 10-year note? Savers are flat on their back in America. Is that the price of trying to keep the banking system going?
I'm worrying more about the idea that Fed policy is punishing savers. Previously I've felt that, everybody has the same investment opportunities. And so, interest rates are low, real interest rates are low, but that's what everybody is facing. And if you want to get more yield, you have to go further out and take more risk. However, I've become more sympathetic to the idea that we're discouraging saving and encouraging borrowing just at the point where there's an awful lot of debt hangover in the economy, and maybe that's not the most appropriate thing to be doing.
But
that's as far as I've got.
That's good. I'll get you in the timeout chair in Washington. when you look at structural unemployment, the theme is the chart I used on the debate the other day. Can there be an economic policy to do away with structural unemployment?
A monetary policy?
Any economic policy to get us out of this?
Well, I'm very concerned. I am very concerned about structural unemployment. The duration of unemployment of the people that are unemployed today is much higher than it's ever been in the U.S. And the level of unemployment is high. We're facing some risk of a European-style hysteresis in unemployment, where unemployment just floats higher, stays higher, and you've got a long-term problem that is very difficult to fix, as the Europeans have learned over the last two decades. So I'm very concerned about that.
My favorite Bullard sentence, the regime switch required has to be sharp and credible. Policymakers have to commit to the new policy, and the private sector has to believe the policymaker. That does not sound like the Congress of the United States. I mean, it's a hope and a prayer, but it's wishful thinking in the ugliness of American democracy, isn't it?
Yeah, there's so much frontier research in macroeconomics over the last two decades, and I just wanted to mention what a great Nobel Prize, I think, was given out here to Tom Sargent and Chris Sims. Tom Sargent in particular has been very important in my career even though I was not his student. But this is the kind of thing that you learn from Sargent and Sims, is how important these expectations are, how important the future path of policy is to current economic outcomes. And so you have to lay out that path in a way that makes sense to the private sector, and that they can understand, then they can go ahead and make their plans for the future. And, you know, even people that don't study macroeconomics or don't talk about this kind of thing every day, they have the intuition that that has to be right. When people say things like leadership matters, that's sort of what they're talking about. And it's so important if you look at the actual research for macroeconomic outcomes.
Leadership matters, courage matters. What would you like to see from the politicians?
Well, we need to get our fiscal house in order in the United States, and it would help us a lot if we could clear up uncertainty about the future fiscal situation. You know, having that cloud of uncertainty sitting out there, looking at those graphs where government spending goes off the chart, you just cannot operate effectively in an environment like that. People are wondering, what is the future of the United States? You have to get those pictures to have some kind of sensible sensible outcomes over 20, 30, 40 years. Once you have that, then people will say, okay, I see what the rules of the game are going to be in the United States, therefore I'm willing to make an investment in the United States.
Someone suggested American exceptionalism started here at the Missouri River. We went west with all the romance of that and the gorgeous Gateway Arch, most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Is that American exceptionalism still there? So many people that Ken and I interview speak of confidence. It's just diminished. You regress Michigan confidence over 15 years, and it's lower. Can we turn that around?
We can absolutely turn that around. America has the best physical capital stock by far, has the best human capital stock by far. A lot of the greatest graduate programs are in the United States. People come here from all over the world. So I think there's a lot of potential for the U.S. going forward. We face one of the biggest challenges we've ever faced as a nation with the rise of the Asian giants, China and India, and that is the real challenge. How to deal with that going forward is the real challenge for the U.S.
Ken?
All right, let me ask another philosophical question. This is a story out of our Washington Bureau this morning. Federal employees whose compensation averages more than $126,000 and the nation's greatest concentration of lawyers helped the Washington, D.C. area edge out San Jose as the wealthiest metropolitan area in the country. What does that tell you?
I'm recalling something Warren Buffett said the other day, which is that his best investment was to hire a lobbyist and send him to Washington.
When you look at what is necessary, I want to circle back to what the Fed can do in the next FOMC meeting without getting into the knitting of it. This is a new Fed. There is dissent. There's visible dissent. You mentioned earlier it is a collegial debate. What signals, what economic indicators are you looking at? We have a wonderful, what we call inside surveillance question, which is how our listeners get questions to people like James Bullard. What are the indicators you use going into this FOMC meeting?
Just the indicators on the economy
Indicators on the economy. What are the measures
well,
that James Bullard
we're,
uses?
We're sort of, famous for looking at everything. So, I think you do have to size up the economic situation on many different dimensions. And certainly there's standard hard data. And by the way, I think the hard data, frankly, has been surprised on the upside.
Macroeconomic advisors is 2.7%.
Surprised on the upside in the last 6 weeks or so. I think we've probably avoided this recession scare that we've been having since August. I think we'll get away here now without a recession. and we'll have reasonably good growth. It won't be rapid growth in the second half of the year, but we'll have reasonably good growth.
Fine. I'll agree with that. How do we translate that into labor formation? Peter Orszag writing in Bloomberg View of where the standard Cobb-Douglas function isn't there anymore because we're so productive and with a global impulse. How do we bring this good economic growth into job formation?
Yeah, I looked at that article a little bit. He's talking about the variability in labor share and capital share. But there are people that have done research on that and have talked about variability in shares, and you could try to match that up with some of the things that have happened here. So it's not unprecedented to think about labor and capital share moving around as opposed to the Cobb-Douglas production function where they're completely constant. Mm-hmm. So people have thought about that a little bit. The article kind of made it sound like it has never happened before, but I think it has.
Mr. Brillard, when you say reasonably good growth ahead, could we pin you down a little bit on that? What sort of GDP are you looking for?
It's not great, but it's better than what people were expecting during the summer. And let me I would say 2 to 2.5% as opposed to less than 2%, which is what people were thinking during the summer. And let me just say, I think the main event during the summer, despite all the noise coming from the fiscal debate and from Europe, the main event during the summer was the GDP revision. On July 29th. If you look at equity markets, they all revalued downward after the July 29th report. And if you look at forecasts, we were just looking at forecasts. My staff was looking at forecasts the other day. You chart them out during the summer, they all go down by about a percentage point for the next year, starting in early August. So what that tells you is everybody basically marked down everything by a lot. That's a lot for a blue chip survey of forecast to go down by a percentage point.
Well, final question, if we could, and get you started on your day here in St. Louis. You look at investment, which you said has been lagging. When we move forward into 2012, where will that investment come from? Do we just assume it must start with housing and that a housing cure has to be before we really see true economic better?
I've said that there's an investment problem in the U.S. Investment is still down 16% or so off its 2007 Q4 peak, whereas all the other components of GDP have more or less recovered. So it's an investment problem. Part of that is uncertainty about future policy in the U.S. I think we'll continue to see strength in business equipment, software. A lot of firms are willing to invest there because it does improve their productivity. But I don't think it's reasonable to think that non-residential structures are going to come back very fast or that residential housing is going to come back very fast. That's going to languish for a long time, and we have to sort of accept that. As the cost of having gone through this bubble. We got the upside of the bubble during 2004, 2005, 2006 when everything was going so well. Now we've got the downside of the bubble in 2011, 2012.
Quickly, would you support a housing policy, some form of new government policy to clear the market?
I'd be willing to look at it, but the ones I've seen so far don't appear to have had much effect and don't appear to be the right type of policy to get something moving.
We're going to get into the dirt here. What is the bet with Richard Fisher, St. Louis, and the Dallas Rangers? What is the bet?
A six-pack of local beer.
What's the local beer here? I don't know.
Well,
Budweiser.
Budweiser.
And
Budweiser.
Lone Star would be the other.
Thank you.
I presume it's Lone Star.
Lone Star. I like this.
Yeah.
You and I would have done a case. Richard, I know it's the Texas Rangers and not the Dallas Rangers. I was just trying to put it's like the New England Patriots. I'm sorry. It's the Boston Patriots. James Bullard, thank you so much.
Listen to Bloomberg Surveillance weekday mornings at 7 on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2011.